Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. When Biden's massive foreign aid package was passed by the U.S. Congress, it was met with much fanfare and political bluster. However, even mainstream media cast doubt on whether this aid will change military realities on the ground. Illusions, it would seem, die hard. Crosstalking Ukraine, I'm joined by my guest, Matthew Crosthen in Washington. He's professor of national security and director of academic transformation at Bowie State University. In Philadelphia, we have Aaron Good. He is a political scientist, historian, as well as author of American Exception, Empire in the Deep State. And in Reston, we cross to Michael Maloof. He is a former Pentagon senior security policy analyst. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Michael, let me go to you first here. You've been watching the coverage of the amazing transformation of Mike Johnson, the U.S. Speaker. But, you know, the media received this package for Ukraine with great fanfare, as I said in my introduction. But even in mainstream media right now, there's a whole lot of questions. I mean, you know, is this a first tranche in over many, many years? What is the strategy? I mean, this is in the mainstream now. We've been talking about it for 2 years. Now it's in the mainstream. So this the divergence between the elites and the media and everybody else is just getting greater and greater. Michael.
Yeah, I think that it's not going to go anywhere. It's not going to amount to much. If anything, the money is going to replenish U.S. stocks. They're going to be getting the Ukrainians, if anything, will get some older stuff. And the Russians have already produced three times as much, maybe five times as much, as what the Ukrainians would be able to throw at them. It's over. The war has been over for some time. It's just a question of pick up and slop and take care and take and mop up. And Zelensky has not seen the need to sit down and preserve what's left of the Ukrainian people. And I might add that we see NATO leaders such as Macron that remain under an illusion, as is the United States, that this is going to have long-term benefits to offset Russia under some false narrative that Russia is on the march like Hitler was. I haven't seen any evidence of any blitzkrieg at all whatsoever. And this is such a vain attempt to try and recast today in the eyes of or in the rear mirror of history, which just doesn't jive. The United States is going to change. The desire to have a 10-year ironclad plan that won't be touched by the United States or any president is folly. If Trump
well,
would have won,
it's hardly even constitutional. Okay, I mean, I think these again, this is kind of unicorn thinking. You know, Matthew, I've said all along over for the last 2 years is that obviously this has very little to do with Ukraine. What it is that NATO is trying to remove Russia from the ranks of great powers. It has not succeeded. As a matter of fact, it's the reverse right now. The whole point is not to lose. It's not to win anymore. And that's a really sad comment for America's great allies in Ukraine. Matthew.
I pretty much agree with that. I've written for a long time on the sense that if the American foreign policy objective is to just sort of bog down and distract Russia with the current conflict, allow the conflict to extend and continue with no real end goal in sight, just to simply make Russia weaker in terms of its global presence on the global stage, I think that's all America is left with trying to do. It isn't trying to recapture territory that's been lost in Ukraine. I don't think it can prop up Zelensky into a bigger type of international statesman. I don't think there's any value in that either. The only value, and it's a what's awkward for me is that the United States right now has a value that it can't really publicly profess, right? The value is we just want this war to keep going because it's just going to grind up more people and more power within the Russian state because it occupies them on that front. It's not a very good look. for the United States to profess that
public. Well, they have people that their profession is double talk. I mean, we've seen it on so many fronts over the last few months. It's not very convincing, I think you would all agree. Aaron, what's also interesting here is that, you know, a cynic would say, and that's my job in being in broadcast journalism, is that this is just a grift, okay? And they just want to keep it going. And we had the Afghan grift. It went on for 20 years. Michael has already brought up, maybe we should try a 10-year plan grift, okay? I mean, this is a grift for, it's welfare for the defense contractors. Aaron.
That seems to be part of the short-term gains for some people and some interests, but this is all money that we're creating out of thin air at this point and adding to the debt. So there's no reason why, if you're going to try to stimulate the economy that way or inject money into the economy by spending in deficit, adding to the deficit, that it has to be military spending. It's tremendously wasteful and stupid, and it can't lead to it's not going to reverse the situation on the ground there, and we're stuck between two bad facets of the U.S. system, which is, number one, the presidents think in terms of very short horizons with their own reelections, and Biden seems really not to want to lose before the election in Ukraine. I think that the talk of a 10-year plan is purely PR. I think even as deluded as they are, they don't really believe that this is going to go on that long. And the other issue is the long-term planning of the U.S., which is not done by people who are elected or responsible public officials, really. They're done by think tanks funded by oligarchs serving the different constituencies of the U.S. empire. And this, for them, decades, they've been pursuing a policy of unipolarity. And the other people, the U.S. political system, with the assassinations of the 60s and even Watergate, they wiped out any sort of progressive internationalism or even nationalism in the form of being on the side of American manufacturers and stuff. I think getting rid of Nixon was the last bit of that. And so you've really had two constituencies, the corporate Rockefeller types and the neocons. And the neocons are the ones who want the unipolar world and unchallenged U.S., the Wolfowitz doctrine, don't allow any country to get strong enough to challenge the U.S. They prevailed in the U.S. and have been more for decades, especially in the 21st century. They basically took control of U.S. foreign policy. There's a little bit of pushback in like 06, 07, just to stop a war with Iran, and more to have the Obama's deal with Iran. That was another case of a little bit of pushback against a neocon foreign policy. But they have still managed to prevail, and they're very intertwined with Zionism. And the British are a part of that, too, because they need the unipolar U.S. for their model to be workable at all. It's just a disaster that's long in the making here. And Biden's own short-term career goals to be reelected are also a factor. And it's just a sad spectacle. It's already killed hundreds of thousands of people. And it will kill more, although I do wonder if the army is going to be the breaking point, not be able to field an army.
There's growing indications there's a lot of insubordination. Soldiers are surrendering or simply running away. But Michael, there's a bigger issue here, something you and I have talked about for many, many years, and it's hubris. I mean, NATO cannot stand the fact that it is on the wrong side of history. It doesn't think in terms of security. It doesn't even think in terms of the military, okay? They just think that they have a right to dictate, and this was an opportunity, again, to move Russia down a few notches. And actually, it's done exactly the reverse. I mean, they have such egg on their face. This is television. After all, I have to watch my language, but you know what I mean.
Yes. Well, this trumped-up war was a godsend for the preservation of NATO. NATO was looking for a new job, basically. They were looking to space. They were looking to the Arctic. They were even looking to the Far East. They couldn't decide what do we do.
They were also looking for girls' education in Afghanistan. That was a big one, too. Don't forget.
Yeah, yes, of course. And so this was a godsend for them. And so the neocons, as our colleague points out, came along and in the form of Tory Nuland and Biden himself, and created this because they wanted to contain Russia. Now, here's what's going to happen. NATO's going to find this as their new well-founded way to exist. And if Ukraine fails, where do they turn? I predict that they're going to turn to Transnistria and the Moldova area to create havoc as an effort to contain Russia. This is, and I think, the Russian planners are seeing this already.
Yep.
And if Israel is to, let's say, get a base in Azerbaijan, and they use that as a stepping point to attack Iran, then this just, the United States won't care. If the United States wants Iran to go away as in its present configuration, because it now has this next effort to keep NATO alive. But if Trump were to come in, I'm hoping that maybe NATO needs to go away. But you're going to see Macron coming on board advocating for a European defense system. And I don't think that's going over too well.
Michael. Is there anybody in the EU that actually supports that? I mean, that's going to cost a whole lot of money. I mean, we just forgot. There's no cheap energy in Europe right now. How are they going to reindustrialize without cheap energy? Keep going.
Well, that's the problem because their industry is down. If they wanted to really crack down and help Ukraine, they'd have to switch from a manufacturing economy to a service economy. And switch from a service economy to a manufacturing economy, and they're not into that. They and it would take years and years, and as you just pointed out, they've cut off their own energy supplies for the most part, and what they're getting is quadruple what they were paying before. So even Germany, which was the richest of all the NATO countries and the EU countries, is finding it difficult to continue this on. And you're seeing countries such as Hungary with Orban beginning to talk about, hey, we need to regain our sovereignty. We need to get out from under Brussels.
No, you have to surrender your sovereignty to NATO. That means to Washington. Yep. That's been the plan all along. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Ukraine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. To remind you, we're discussing Ukraine. Okay, let's go to Matthew, back to Matthew in Washington, D.C. One of the mantras that we have heard here, and it's been part of this administration's DNA, is the autocracy versus democracy, world-based order, all of these laws-based order. But we have this kind of inconvenience coming up is Zelensky, and his term comes to an end on May 20th. There were no elections. So what about the political legitimacy of the entire regime in Kyiv? Soon, none of them will have been legally elected to power. Go ahead, Matthew.
To be honest, I think that's the one area right now, as long as there's an active war going on, it's hard to try and profess that Ukraine should be holding free and fair elections.
Well, I mean, the United States, Ukraine would not be in the state that is without the support of the United States. The United States could have said, have elections. They had elections in Afghanistan. The United States had elections in 1864. So I'm sorry, I'm not into excuses.
There's this, but I agree on the sense that that's not really the goal or the purpose in supporting Zelensky, right? Like, the United States is not supporting Zelensky to make Zelensky this archetype of Eastern European democracy.
I think they are. They say it all the time.
There's a difference between what we're professing we want him to be and what in actuality is happening on the ground in terms of what our support is meaning to him on the ground and what he does with that support in Ukraine, factually. This is not propping up a Ukrainian democracy long term, short term, medium term. And we will allow, this is where the United States often will get itself into trouble in foreign affairs, is it will say it stands for democracy, it says it stands for civil rights and human rights and democratic freedoms. But then as soon as some of that runs afoul with its actual foreign policy interests, we focus on the foreign policy interests and the principled debates, the principled commentaries sort of take a backseat.
Well, yeah, Aaron, because first of all, elections have been canceled. Opposition parties have been disbanded. There is only one media outlet. It's the state. The attack, the Orthodox Church. Dissent is frowned upon, if not imprisonment on the agenda. I can't see how they can talk about democracy very much.
No, but this was a group of a generally far-right kind of Ukrainian nationalism that characterized this regime since the U.S. installed it in 2014. And wartime, a total war, only kind of amplifies fascistic trends in politics, I mean, to put it mildly. So I don't know that they're going to rise up and demand democracy. I think they're mostly trying. The people that are would they be able to stand up to the state anyway are the ones that are, you know, military age males, and they're running out of them. I don't know that I think the election could be used as a way to criticize or to diminish his legitimacy internationally if you're a foe of the Ukraine regime. But I don't know how much impact it's going to have in terms of the way things operate. It's going to be a dictatorship before the election deadline passes or afterwards, and they're going to continue to try to mobilize as many people to throw into this meat grinder as possible until the money stops.
You know, Michael, one of the things that I really worry about as the Ukrainian lines begin to waver and break, and like I said earlier, there's ample information available that there are a lot of troops that are surrendering, won't obey orders, simply running away. I'm worried about asymmetrical stuff, terrorism, in another word. We've seen the Ukraine, backed by the United States, they wouldn't do it if the U.S. didn't know, engaging in these practices here. When panic sets in, that kind of behavior will only increase. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, I think that this is all that they can resort to. They have lost the war. They've lost the battle space, and they can't even mount a defense any longer because they're running away from the advances by Russia internally. But I don't see Russia holding on, going beyond that. What I'm going to be seeing, however, is countries such as Poland, Lithuania, and all these other countries trying to chip away at West Ukraine and take back some share from ancient treaties and republics that they used to dominate centuries and centuries ago. And this and the nation state of Ukraine will no longer exist as an entity, a viable entity. But this country has. I'm under no illusion that Zelensky has never been Democrat in thinking. The fact that they didn't hold elections undercut the narrative that we're supporting a democracy. It's all delusional. It's not illusional. It's delusional. And NATO is in the same way because many of the NATO countries are acting very, very acting in the same way, very anti-democratic, and they no longer. Hold the principles for which they were established in the first place. I mean, they're running amok, and they're looking for a new order to retain that old order that they're quickly losing. And we're seeing the emergence of a multipolar world order. And as my friend Alexander Dugin once talked about when we were together about the creation of a multipolar world order. We're now seeing it happen. We're seeing some 40 nations that want to join BRICS. They want to get out from under the dollar. They've had enough of this rules-based order that is dictated by the U.S. and those rules are dictated by what the U.S. says they are. On one day, they may not agree. They may not follow them the next day, but it's all based on what the U.S. decides, and the world is sick of it.
You know, Matthew, I'm going to do a couple of programs over the next few weeks on the following topic, going at it from different trajectories. Are we in the middle of the Third World War?
I've actually written a lot about this, where I try to give argumentation to at least try to stay somewhat on the optimistic side.
But I mean, it's already been brought up in this program, which I think is kind of interesting. What happens if, you know, Israel sets up a base in Azerbaijan? You know, Russia's going to have to react to that. Iran, I mean, everybody's getting slowly but surely pulled into this matrix here. That's why I think it's kind of interesting. And we see different sides developing, okay? And very few people get allowed in the middle. That's a very toxic mix. Go ahead, Matthew.
No, it completely is. And that, unfortunately, World War III, an actual, like, being a Gen Xer, growing up in an era when I was a small child, we were truly worried about nuclear holocaust. And we used to do the elementary school alarm drills and things, hide under your
desk. Well, Michael and I are a lot older. We went through the same thing. Don't worry. Okay.
But because of that, I've also probably grown up with the idea that, but in the end, that button didn't get pushed. So there's probably psychologically in my own mind the sense that surely no nation or group of nations today would allow themselves to push that button. We could create the framework and create a structure globally that puts us right on the precipice of it. But I still actually want to believe, despite my cynical national security heart, that no one would be that fundamentally insane.
Well, that's a really interesting question, Aaron, because I think the threshold of being the threshold of fear of nuclear weapons has actually been lowered. I mean, I think policymakers are a lot more cavalier than, let's say, when Michael and I were growing up, you know, during mutual destruction. And I think that, you know, the people are more cavalier about it. What do you think, Aaron?
It's hard to say what really is going on at the top of the American state, because we all have a sense that, everyone knows Biden is the head of state, and everyone has a sense that Biden is not in charge. And everyone has a sense that the pronouncements of these people like Sullivan and Kirby and Blinken are that they can't be what they really think. And so we're left to wonder really how much stability or sense there is at the very top. And the best evidence for there being any sense at all is that they haven't blown up the world yet. But that is really damning them with faint praise, I think, we'd have to say. And it gets to the heart of what the U.S. has been doing and how insane that is to begin with, which is they've wanted to rule the world. They realized in the, you know, around the Reagan era or so, the neocons decided that they would really try to take down the Soviet Union, and they were successful with financial war and supporting civil society in Eastern Europe, crashing, putting countries in debt in the Eastern Bloc, crashing the price of oil, getting them embroiled in a war in Afghanistan. All these things brought down the Soviet Union, which some people, even George H.W. Bush, was saying, we might not want to do this. But Dick Cheney was even arguing with him publicly at the time, and he was the Secretary of Defense, because Cheney represented a more powerful faction, apparently, than the president. And the neocons prevailed, and they wanted to go for this unipolar world order where it would challenge anyone. And ultimately, they're running into this nuclear issue. And it's very foreseeable that this is what they're running into. It's what they should have realized would have happened in Ukraine anyway in 2014, and they shouldn't have attempted it. But here we are. And if they played brinksmanship up to now with this, we should be worried.
We should be very, very worried because historically,
historically,
hegemons never give up willingly. And this is what this is all about. There are vectors around the world challenging hegemony, and the U.S. will not back down. That's why I've talked about, are we in the middle of the Third World War? We don't call it that yet, but we might be in it. Michael.
Yeah, it takes on many forms. We're building up to it. And I think that if we continue acting the way we are and don't listen to the warnings of red lines, such as Mr. Putin has pointed out, then something is catastrophic is going to happen. I agree with you. This talk of this blasé talk of, well, we might use nuclear weapons. If they only realized the impact and the force of a nuclear weapon, they would calm down and quit blithely talking about this as if it was the dropping of some 500-pound bomb someplace. It's not. It's much more devastating, and it kills tens of thousands of people. And we could see a slow death from it in whatever form World War III takes. It could be the use of an EMP at 200, 300 miles up, exploding a nuclear weapon up there with a, from a satellite. And the slow death would occur when all of your electronics and your and your other critical infrastructures that rely
These weapons exist.
Yes, they do.
And because they exist, they can be used. Gentlemen, we're going to end on that note. I want to thank my guests in Washington, Reston, and in Philadelphia. And, of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.